He's the famous frontman pulling double duty for both the Angels and the Screaming Jets. But even one of the busiest musos in Australia still has to stop for lunch and a chat to Oz Music's biggest names. This is the Oztober Lunch with Gleeso from the Screaming Jets.
And this is our Lunch with Gleeso catch-up podcast, with conversations you may have missed earlier and the parts we just didn't have time to play today.
Celebrating all things as we are Australian music through this month of Oztober, we've got Brian Canham from Pseudo Echo on the line. Hey, Brian, how you going?
Hey, guys. Yeah, good. Thanks.
Mate, take us back. 1982, boom, Pseudo Echo arrive.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a boom. We were happily playing the traps, and who else should turn up to one of our gigs other than Molly Meldrum?
Back in the day, he was scouting for talent, wasn't he, to go on Countdown?
Yeah, he was, and I think, you know, somebody tipped him off to have a look at us, and he popped by a gig, and it was a good gig, luckily. Yeah, it could have been a crap one, but it was a good attendance and you know, good vibe, and he'd seen the whole show, so I think he was impressed, and he came back and introduced himself, and then pretty much within about a week or so, he'd contacted our management and arranged to have us on the show, which was so strange to us because we didn't have a record deal or anything. It was company policy that you had to have a record deal or at least right. Something, you know, with some sort of a label, and we had nothing. So Molly sort of took a bit of a gamble there, and he got the crew to sort of do a bit of moonlighting over the weekend and put together a clip for us, and then he just sort of basically debuted us on Countdown unofficially.
I think to me that was one of the magic parts of the Melbourne scene, is that as opposed to the Sydney scene, there was a chance that someone from Countdown or someone from that yeah. type of era might be at your show, might pass on, hey, you've got to go and check these guys out, and you had that chance of getting this national audience. Obviously, you had hits with Living in a Dream, Listening, A Beat for You, but Funky Town absolutely propelled you to the next level, didn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't a bad fluke, that one. A song that I sort of knew from my late teens, you know, when I started going to clubs and sort of checking out the scene, and funny thing was is that it's funny how nostalgia is when you're young. You know, when you're 20 or 22, you know, when you think back to when you're 18, that seems nostalgic because it seems like a long time ago, even though it's a few years. But to me, you know, hearing that song, a friend of mine just played it to me, you know, maybe 3-4 years later, and it seemed so nostalgic, and I had such a connection with the song because I remembered it was when we started really listening to songs and getting inspired for our own music. I sort of just... It was stuck in my head after hearing it that night, and the next day at soundcheck with the band, which was the most time we'd sort of jam and rehearse and things, I just started sort of jamming it, and the guys started following along. Yeah, it was one of those things that just sort of went, it's such an easy song to play, and it's good for me because I haven't got many words, because I hate remembering lyrics. But, and so we just said, you know what, we should put this in the set tonight. So we threw it in the encore, and we were so surprised and overwhelmed by the reaction. So we just started doing that every night in the encore, and then at the time when Eon FM was predecessor to Triple M, obviously, and Lee Simon was the program manager, that we shared an office with them in South Bank. I remember walking past Lee in the corridors one day, and he said, "You've got to release that song." And I didn't really know what he was talking about. And then he said, "Oh, somebody gave me a desk tape of Funky Town." He goes, "I've heard it. He goes, I've got a vibe. You guys have to record it. It's a smash." So when you get that kind of vibe from the program manager, you know, you don't really mess around, do you?
And of course, look, we have a mutual friend who's passed now, Aaron Chugg, who went on your tour of the United States after that and said it was just absolutely off the charts.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was great. It was a great time back then, and you know, we were a big happy family touring, and it was great.
That led to quite a bit of time spent in the States.
Yeah, we did a couple of trips, and we did some massive touring over there. You know, with the In real rock star style too, with the big whopping tour buses and everything. It was fantastic.
He told me stories of like the start of the Beatles cartoon where maybe, you know, sending decoys off this way and decoys off that
right.
way and the
well,
band comes out.
You know, we were young, cute guys, so we were going to get hassled by young girls, weren't we?
But we flash forward all these years, and you guys are still out there on the road. What do you attribute, you know, your love of touring to?
I think I like to keep it fresh with the band. keep everybody with a really positive attitude and you know, everyone wanting to tour for the right reasons, and that's been a big part of it. And keep reviewing how we are, how we sound, how we look, you know, keeping in check with our fans to make sure they're getting enough variety as well.
I mean, that's obviously a new thing, a different thing than it used to be. Fan clubs back in the day as opposed to you know, Facebook, et cetera, in this day and age.
Yeah, well, I guess you get instant feedback, you know, online and social media, and it's become such a big thing now that it's you can't just ignore it. So it's definitely a thing to be across and know your audience.
New music, what are you been recording anything new? You got anything new in the pipeline?
Yeah, well, we've had a couple of things happen. Firstly, I discovered some old recordings, a couple of lots. We released some very early recordings that we call our 301 demos, because we demoed them at the Studio 301 in Sydney when we were doing our first album. Now, this material was, like, we had about 40 songs or so when we did our first album. We had to whittle it down to 10. So there were a lot of songs. I think we demoed about maybe 20. So there's almost another album's worth of material that just didn't make it on there. And not really because it wasn't good enough, just because we had to draw the line somewhere. And so it was hard. We had to really sacrifice certain songs. And then by the time the second album came along, we'd evolved a little bit and progressed a bit with our sound. So those first songs that didn't make it didn't really match up. Some did and some were revived, and but some were left. So we ended up collating those early songs, and as they were just sort of, we were set up live in the studio and we just laid them down. They weren't really mixed or anything done to them. They were just us playing. And we released them on an album called 301 Demos, and we're going to tour that next year. But in between there and now, we are writing new material as well. There were some more archives that we found from the 90s. We could come across this stuff. and then archives in the 90s were, I think they were intended to be my solo album, which I got sidetracked from when I started producing other bands, such as Chocolate Starfish and Chantuzies and so on. So these things sort of curveballed me and I got into producing again and sort of forgot my own stuff. And then it was only recently that I discovered this vault of all my old demos and went, my God, I've got an office worth of material here too. So that's something that we may review, and we've just got to work out whether it goes under a pseudo's banner or just under my own title. There's definitely new material as well. So we're constantly kind of retweaking it, and it's got a fit in with our live set, obviously. So these things are important that we sort of jam a bit at sound checks or throw a bit into the set, you know, to just see tempos and grooves if it's sort of not too far away from where we're at. That's on the horizon. And other than that, strangely enough, I'm writing a book with my wife, so that's been a real big time-consuming thing. And we've still got a long way to go, but these are just all strange sort of little anecdotes of things that have happened through my life leading me to where I am.
Nice. And,
I never really thought about them being that interesting until I sort of, you know, talked about a few of these things to my wife and to my friends, and they'd all always be saying, God, these are so interesting. And then some filmmakers that I was talking to were asking me about, you know, doing a short film or stuff like this. So I thought, well, maybe they're not as boring as I think. Maybe they are a bit interesting. To me, they're just my life. So I didn't know any other life, so I never really thought of them as being story-worthy or film-worthy. It's definitely a thing we're going to do. And Raquel, of course, she does all our social media photography and all that as well. So she gets a lot of behind-the-scenes and unusual sort of photography, you know, following us around, and just, you know, things that you wouldn't normally see as a photograph because they're not totally planned or not posed for. So these will make up a big part of the book as well, because I can throw back some stories that relate to the pictures.
Are there any people you've toured with over the years, Brian, that have kind of left an indelible stamp on you?
Yeah, I guess lots, really. I mean, I think in the early days we did a bit of touring with bands like we did some shows with the Eurythmics. Even, strangely enough, in the 2000s with my band Origine, that I had a sort of a trancey act, we toured with Kylie Minogue, and that was that was very interesting. You know, it was a complete different view, and, you know, being in the underdog band and just opening up, and it was really good. I think more than touring is probably when I've produced bands, I've worked with some unusual acts over the years. And some that people probably would never, ever pair me with would be acts like Lee Kernaghan. Lee, I did some remixes for, and I remember he was so happy with them at the time. He asked me to do his whole album like that. But I think within the camp, because it's a traditional country, they were a little bit stunned at that, and they sort of went, "Oh, hang on, can't do this, Lee." But he was keen. I was really surprised how open-minded he was, and he really grasped it. Yeah, it was kind of just a sort of a slightly electrified version of what he did. So he did release one of them somewhere. I can't remember what the song was called, but it was good. And another act that was very unusual to work with was Kamal.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that was the most amazing experience, really, because Kamal's such a gentleman and he's such a pro. And he'd come over to my place in Hawthorne and we'd sit down and I think it was for a campaign or something. I had to do some stuff with him. And I remember saying, "Okay, let's try this line." And he sung some stuff, and I said, "Okay, well, look, let's plonk a harmony over this part." And he said to me, "You know, I've never sung a harmony with myself ever."
Yeah, right.
He said, "You know, they always just get someone in to do them or whatever." And honestly, he sounds like an Indian Barry White. the guy's got such a cool voice; I couldn't believe it. It was just
awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Brian. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, celebrating Oztober, Australian music in all its glory, and we'll hopefully catch you out on the road somewhere.
You bet.
This is the Oztober Lunch with Gleeso.